Aaliyah Aga, I can't believe I'm seeing you. You look exactly the same. You haven't changed. How are you?
I'm doing really well, Matt. I'm doing great. Thank you. And you look fabulous.
Oh, well, thank you. Yes, I do what I can. It's so funny. Like, it's so much fun, like, doing all these, because the best is, like, it's only audio that people hear, but we get to see each other on Zoom. And so many people, like, I haven't seen in 25 or more years.
Yeah.
So it's so cool.
Yeah.
Now I realize I feel like almost the entire time I was at ILM, you were there, but mm-hmm. we'll get into that, I think. But I realize I know you from work, and mm-hmm. you were always somebody that I remember, you know, we would chat and I'd see you in the hallway, and I think we worked on some shows together, but I don't really know much about you, about your background. And so I'll start where I start with everybody, which is, where are you from? Where'd you grow up?
Okay. Well, I grew up in Monterey, California, but I am an immigrant. I was born in Damascus, Syria. And when I was a year and a half, I fled Syria with my family. My father was having political difficulties. There was a change in regime in the Syrian government, and he was a target. Mm-hmm. The story is great. It's miniseries quality. My parents were at some sort of government ball, and my mother's Brazilian. My mother's from Brazil, and the Brazilian ambassador asked my mother to dance. And while they were dancing, he said to her, "Keep smiling. I have something to tell you. And nobody can know this." And so as they were dancing, he said, "Your husband is in grave danger. You need to take your family and leave Syria immediately. Come to my office tomorrow and we'll make arrangements for you."
No way. Wow.
And they did. And the Brazilian government prepared false passports for all of us. I was a year and a half at the time. My brothers are about 7 and 8 at the time. And my mother sewed our real passports into the lining of my brother's coat. And the night before we left, my parents took us to visit the family. And my parents knew that was the last time we would probably see them, but they didn't know. They thought it was just a visit because the Brazilian consulate had told them, "Tell nobody you're leaving, leave all your money in the bank, just take what you can carry. Don't move furniture, don't show any sign of movement." And that's what my family did. So in the middle of the night, one night, one suitcase for the family of five got into a cab and took that cab 150 miles to the mountains of Lebanon, where we hid out for a month with a family. And my oldest brother remembers during that time that once a week, a man in a white van would come to the bottom of the road. My father would go down and talk to him and then come back. That happened every week. One time after these visits, my father came back and said, "Pack your bags, we're leaving tomorrow." And what that man was arranging passage for us. So the next day he picked us up, took us to the port of Lebanon, where we boarded a ship, third class. We were down in steerage. And when the boat got to Alexandria, Egypt, it was stopped by the police. They did a sweep and they took a lot of people from this political fallout off the boat. My father, of course, was hiding at the bottom of the boat with us. And that's where we stayed until we got to the Straits of Gibraltar. And we came up I've got a photograph of my mother holding me in my, and she's got a big smile on her face. And my brother said that in that photograph, that was the first time he had seen her smile since all of this had begun, because we were finally free and clear. We took that boat to Brazil, where my mother's family greeted us. And we stayed in Brazil for about another year and a half. And then when I was 3 years old, we immigrated to Anaheim. So after all that political intrigue, we ended up living a mile from Disneyland. And
now, so, wait, what? So what year was it that your family fled?
1958.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
And I have to confess my Middle Eastern history. I'm pretty ignorant of what was happening in the country at the time.
During that time, the Baas Party, which was a socialist party, came into power. So the first president, Assad, was leading that. And my father was educated in the United States, and he was very pro-American. And he was, at the time, director of agricultural extension. He was an agricultural engineer. He was the director of agricultural extension in Syria. And one of his jobs was to travel and make speeches about agriculture and agricultural development within the Middle East. And he continually praised the United States as having the best agricultural system in the world, and that was the model he wanted to base his work on. That was interpreted by people who were anti-American as treason, basically. That he was being pro-American, and so this new party that emerged was very much anti-American.
Yeah.
And because of his affiliation with the United States and his love of California agriculture, he became a target.
Wow, that is such a crazy story. Now, how did he and your mom meet each other? Do you know?
Yes, that's yet another miniseries story.
Because yes, Syria and Brazil, like that seems like a pretty
wild connection. Yeah, no, that's another story. So my mother's father, my maternal grandfather, a man named Tufik, was from Syria. He was from a small town in Jobur. When he was 13, he got into a terrible fight with his father and ran away from home. And he went to the port and found a ship and told the captain, "I want to go to the end of the earth. Just take me away." And the captain said, "Okay, well, you can shovel coal. You can work you for your passage." And when that ship got to the port it was in the Amazon, a town called Itacoatiara. When it got to that port, the captain said, "Okay, boy, this is the end of the earth. I'm heading back. Come on, I'll take you home." And my grandfather said, "No, I'm not going back." And he jumped ship and he lived on the streets until a Middle Eastern family actually met him and took him in. And he worked. He eventually had a store, a shop, and he traveled up and down the river in his boats. He had boats. Trading with the natives, you know, he would take dried goods and he'd bring back skins and, you know, products from the forest, and eventually developed an international import export business and was very wealthy. So in 1948, after World War II, let me back up. So during this time, he married my grandmother, who was half native and half Portuguese.
Oh, wow.
And they had six daughters together. My mother was the oldest of the six daughters. Her favorite movie actually was Fiddler on the Roof, because it reminded her of her family, you know, this man who had to marry off six girls. Anyway, so by 1948, two of the daughters were married, and four, and my mother included, were still unmarried. And my grandfather at that point decided he wanted to go back to Syria and see his father. He had heard word that his father wasn't doing well. So he wanted to take his family back to meet his father. So they took a ship. Back then, they traveled steam liners. So they took a ship. When they got, again, to the port of Egypt, Alexandria, Egypt, there was a massive storm, and they were delayed for a week. And during that week, my great-grandfather died. And so he never got to see his son again or meet his son's family. So they stayed in Syria for a while, just visiting family and, you know, sightseeing. And it was during that time that they were staying in Damascus that my mother met my father. Long story to tell you, to answer.
Wow. That's so amazing. I mean, you're not kidding. Both of those would make incredible movies or like miniseries or something. Like, I mean, just the drama in all of that and the the circuitous nature of those kinds of the randomness in a way of those connections too. Like, that's really incredible. Growing up as a kid, like, once you do you have any memory of living in Brazil before coming to?
I do. I mean, I was very small, 2.5. But I do. Some of my first memories, one of my very first memory is, hold on just a second. There's a dog barking here. Bowie. My first memory is of sitting in my aunt's kitchen in Sao Paulo eating hot banana cereal. That's my very first memory.
Cool.
And my second memory is being carried by one of my uncles on a tarmac to get on a plane to fly to Miami when we were leaving Brazil. My third memory is being on my mother's lap in that airplane, throwing up into a paper bag. I remember the stewardesses with their little hats and their little uniforms and all that. So that was 1960. We came to the United States in 1960, and we flew to Miami, into Miami. And my parents didn't have a lot of money at that point. You know, that all the political intrigue and travel had pretty much drained. They weren't able to bring money with them. They really were pretty much traveling on my mother's jewelry.
What was the impetus to move to the United, to immigrate to the United States?
There were a variety of reasons. My father was not happy in Brazil. He had, like I said, he had studied in the United States. He loved the United States. He loved California. He had made some very, very strong friendships while he was in university. And then the final thing is that I needed a surgery, and they had taken me to doctors everywhere in the world. They stopped. And my father believed that the only doctors worthy of operating on his daughter were in the United States. So those things combined brought us to the United States. And I did, in fact, have surgery very shortly after we arrived in Anaheim at the Children's Orthopedic Hospital. So
did you wind up then, and how old were you when
I was three.
Three. Oh, wow. So really little.
I was very little, yes.
So did you grow up then in Southern California?
No. We, my father went from his government position to working as a laborer on a chicken ranch in Turlock, wow, California. I mean, he needed to support his family, so he took any work he could find. And he eventually found a job at the Defense Language Institute in Monterey, California, as an Arabic instructor. And so that's how we moved to Monterey. And I spent the rest of my childhood and adolescence in Monterey.
I mean, that must have been so, like, I wonder, was it difficult, or was it exciting, or was it just kind of the norm in your family, like growing up, like moving a lot until you landed in that one spot?
I think it was sort of the norm, and you know, my dad had a nomadic nature. So even within Monterey, we pretty much moved every 2 years. So we lived in every town on the peninsula. So yeah, we were always moving. Yeah.
Now, growing up, did you go living there? Did you go to like public school, private school?
No. The surgery I had was a bone graft in my hip, my right hip. Mm-hmm. So my parents were very protective of me. I wasn't allowed to fall down. I wasn't allowed to do anything that might damage my hip. And they were worried. So when I was in first grade, a boy pushed me off the monkey bars, and that made me really mad. So I started chasing him because I was going to punch him out. And I ended up slipping on some sand and scraping the entire side of my leg that had just been operated on a few years ago. Mm-hmm. That freaked my parents out, and that was it. They were never going to allow me to go to school with boys again because I might get damaged. So my punishment was to be placed in an all-girls school. So I went to an all-girls school for 10 years, 8 to 18.
Wow.
Yeah.
And
Yeah.
So, okay, so your parents are, I mean, you know, I get it. You're the baby of the family and like you had to have this operation. And so they're really protective of you and want to make sure you're safe and stuff. As a parent myself, I get that. That makes sense to me in some ways. So growing up, like then you're going to this all-girls school from 8 to 18. And like, are you, what are the kinds of things that you're interested in? Are there things, do you, I mean, knowing where we wind up meeting later, like, were you interested in art or were you creative kid? Yeah. Like, did you draw?
Yeah. Yeah. Actually, well, you know, one of the silver linings of having had the surgery and having had overprotective parents who wouldn't allow me to go outside and play with the other children was that they would buy me absolutely any art supply I wanted. You know, if I wanted to learn how to knit, they'd buy me all the supplies and I would learn how to knit. If I wanted to learn calligraphy, they'd buy me the pens, you know, sculpting, clay, everything I wanted. So my bedroom as a child was pretty much an art studio. I had any kind of art supply I wanted. And I just spent hours and hours and hours alone in my room, drawing, painting, sculpting, whatever struck me in the moments. Models. I love model kits. That was the other thing they bought me tons of. I was
really
always building models. Oh yeah, yeah. Cars.
What kind of cars and stuff?
Cars and you know, my you know, I had a flipper model. That was too easy though, because it was a flipper. What do you do?
Yeah.
You
stick together, couple right? parts you know, snap them together and
I like
there's
the kind
flipper.
That, but monsters, I mean anything. I just love model kits. I was always, you know, building models.
Oh, that's really cool. Now, did you, so you had two older brothers. Were they into that kind of stuff too? Or were they?
Yeah, they I think were the ones who got me interested in the model kits because they had model kits and, you know, and then if they didn't use them or if they just sat aside, you know, they'd give them to me, you know, and I'd do them, you know, and that got me into it. But yeah, they were into that. They were into comic books and, you know, Saturday afternoon B movies, you know, lots of monster films. We watched monster films together, all that, you know, so in essence, I was probably training for this job at a very early age.
Do you think a lot of that, like those interests, like did it all come just innately from your brothers, or did some of that, was your, either of your parents, were they into art or movies or things of that nature, or was it?
Both my parents were movie fans. I mean, they learned, being from, you know, foreign countries, they learned to love the United States through movies.
Yeah.
And, you know, my mother knew all the actresses. She knew all the gossip about all the actresses because she read all the magazines and, you know, and we would watch movies together. That's what they did. You know, every week my father took me to movies and they talked about movies and it was a big deal in our house.
Yeah, that's really cool.
Yeah. And my mother was an artist. She, you know, she went to an all-girls school in Brazil and her, one of her roles was to paint like the sacred cloths that they used on the altar. You know, I mean, she was a very talented artist and she passed that on to me, you know, and she was the one who taught me how to oil paint. She taught me how to draw, you know, in perspective and that sort of thing. So
really, so did she continue, like, did your mother continue like to practice like either painting or art making, like all, like even by the time you guys got to California and stuff, she continued making art on her own?
No. She sort of lived through me.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. You know, she pretty much gave that all up. I think just the pressure and the dynamics of their lives and having to escape a country and then raise a family in the United States and, you know, all that I think was just a lot for her. So she pretty much, you know, gave up her talents. And that was actually that was a significant influence on me because I knew my mother had sacrificed her loves to be a mother and a wife. And And she was very, very focused on me developing as an artist and me developing as a career woman. It's almost as though she did not want to see me go through what she had to go through.
Really?
So
yeah.
She was a very strong influence. She would not let me give up on anything. If something was difficult and I wanted to give up on it, she'd stick her finger on my nose and say, "There is no such thing as I can't. Now do it." And that was the training my mother gave me. And I think that's pretty much what got me through my career.
I mean, that's really cool, though.
Yeah,
and that
yeah.
really speaks to, you know, her dedication, commitment, her love of her children and wanting to see you guys have that level of commitment and success.
Yeah.
Did you, so in the girls' school, as you're, when you become like a, enter the teenage years and stuff, like, are you, do you have a, like a good group of friends and people who are kind of interested in doing similar activities and stuff?
Yeah. Yeah. I had my arts friends, you know, my artsy yep. group, and
I guess I'm wondering, were there things like as you get further into school and you're kind of approaching the tail end of high school, mm-hmm. are there thoughts in your mind about like what comes next? Like, do you have a set of goals, like things that you're starting to aim for?
Yes, yes. Because it was a college preparatory school, we were always focused on what's next. That was that was sort of the impetus of the school. You know, not only were we raised to be ladies, but we were raised to be productive individuals. Yes, in fact, and again, because of my mother's love of movies, when I had slumber parties and all my friends came over, she would stay up with us and we would watch classic movies all night long.
Oh,
and
that's so
she,
cool.
And she was into it and we were into it. There was, during that time, this was in the early 70s, there was a show on TV at 3 a.m. called Silence, Please, and it was silent movies. They played silent movies. And my friends and I were passionate about silent movies.
Really? That's so interesting.
We would sit in the library for hours researching all the books, learning about Lillian Gish and D.W. Griffith and Theda Bara. Theda Bara was sort of our icon. And
what was it about her that was so captivating, do you think?
Oh, because she was bad. She was,
yeah.
She was the vamp, you know. So on free dress days, we would dress like silent movie stars and get in trouble. We put on like the black makeup around our eyes.
Wow,
and, you know,
that's so cool. That's so kind of like, that's so kind of like subculture-ish too, though. Like a group of friends.
We were very much into the subculture of it all. You know,
that is so cool.
Yeah, that's
so original. Like, what a neat kind of thing for a group of young girls to get into, young women, you know.
Yeah, well, we it was our fantasy life, you know. We just kind of pretended we were silent movie stars, and that was, you know, for lack of extracurricular activities and dating and boys and things like that, we had a very active fantasy life.
Was your house and your mom, was it your house, was that where people congregated, your friends?
Sometimes.
Just thinking of that movie connection, I wondered if that was maybe something that came out of your household as opposed to one of the other.
Yeah, it was. I think there was also a culture. There was also a cultural element to it during the 70s. I mean, American Graffiti was coming out. The Indiana Jones films were coming out. And there was a lot of throwback to the 40s, you know, and even beyond. The 50s, if you look at the fashion, you know, that was the other thing that we did. We just scoured secondhand stores for vintage clothing, you know, all the little jackets with the shoulder pads. And
it's so funny, though, because like, I feel like kids still do that. Like my son and his friends, like that's all they do is like, they still go to all the like thrift stores and stuff looking for like old clothes. And to them, old clothes are, you know, things from the, you know, 80s, right? Or sort of the 90s or something. It's like, oh man, these are so old. They're so cool. It's so funny. That seems like a rite of passage of young people for for quite a long time now.
I think so.
It's being it's probably different. Too, when you're a kid, you can afford it, right? Because it's all cheaper.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and older people in the neighborhood would give me stuff, you know, they'd see me wearing, he was like, oh, I have a jacket I haven't worn in decades. Here, take it, you know?
That's so cool.
So
like it's a college preparatory school. And so do you go to university?
Well, yes. Yes. I mean, because again, my parents were overprotective. When I graduated from high school, my father made me the offer. And he was sort of tough and about things and stubborn. And he said, well, you have no experience in life. I'm not comfortable with you going off to university, a four-year college. So if you stay home and go to the community college for 2 years and then transfer to a four-year college, I'll pay for everything. But if you choose to go off on your own, you're on your own. And I said, I'm not going to a community college. You know, I was just prepared for university. I'm going to university. So I was on my own. I put myself through college. I went to San Francisco State University.
It was all right. Go Gators.
Go
Me too.
Gators. Yay. I didn't know. And I was in the film school. I don't know if you went to film school.
I was too.
Yeah.
No
Ron
Lovaco
was my advisor. I don't know if he was there when you were there. Bill Shays was one of my teachers. So I went to film school in 1975 at San Francisco State University. Fabulous time to be in San Francisco. And then after a few years, I could no longer afford a film major. I couldn't, because of course there wasn't, we didn't have videos, we didn't have iPhones, everything was prints and answer prints and processing.
Which was so expensive. Same as when went, even in the late 80s, early 90s, there was video, but it was like still everything was being shot on, you know, 16 or 35, and it was so expensive as a student.
So in light of that, my advisor told me, and I think this was excellent advice. He said, you know, movies are made in the head before they're made on film. Maybe you should take a degree in screenwriting, and that, you know, and that way you can still be making movies, but on paper, and it's a lot cheaper for you.
Yeah.
And I took that advice, and then I transferred to UC Berkeley on my father's directive, because he had gone to Berkeley and wanted me to go there. So we were making up at this point.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it is for some things, for sure. It's definitely a better school, a more prestigious school, for sure.
Yeah. I mean, it was probably not the best choice in terms of getting to prepare myself for a career in film, but I did get a degree in writing from Berkeley through the humanities department. And
so wait, I do have to ask though, I mean, you kind of have alluded to this. I'm wondering if the decision to go to San Francisco State and to study in the film program, like, I mean, that's very specific. And coming out of your school, and I get you were always into movies, but like, was there in your mind's eye, like the decision to engage in a course of study connected to filmmaking and storytelling in that way? What do you think that came from? Like, is there a specific drive, like, or something, a lens that focused you in that kind of specific direction?
One of the things I got involved with in high school was theater, not only acting, but directing. And my senior project, we all had to have some kind of senior project that we presented to the school community at the end of our final year. My senior project was to direct the play, the Glass Menagerie.
Oh, cool.
And so that's what I did. And I worked with our theater director, fabulous, fabulous woman named Charlotte Perry. Really old school. She was probably in her 80s when she was teaching us. So she had been around forever and had been a theater instructor for a lot of very interesting people. So I worked directly with her to learn studied the book on directing, and, you know, and part of, because it was academic, I had to write entire analysis of the play and all the dynamics. And then I directed. And it was that experience of directing that just turned me on so much. And that was my initial interest was in San Francisco State was to direct. And I took some classes in the theater department, but I wasn't I found myself gravitating towards film. So I just transferred.
Did you ever act, or was it mostly directing was the drive?
Yeah, directing was my drive.
Do you know what it was? Like when you did the play, like I'm just so curious, like what specifically about directing was it? Like the whole thing, or was there like something about sort of overseeing all those pieces? Or I mean, it's kind of an interesting choice.
It was to realize a vision. Because in reading the play and planning it, I could see it. I could see it in my mind. I could see exactly what I wanted to the play to be. And so it was getting that on stage, you know, communicating with the actors, planning it out. I mean, I don't know if it was a high school production, so who knows, you know, the quality was at high school
level.
But
it's like you have to start somewhere, you know.
Yeah, exactly. and so I thought I would like directing film, but you know, I think that once I got into it, I realized that it was directing was probably not what I wanted to do. So I decided then I would go and perhaps be a camera operator, a camera person. So, you know, and so it was just, I just went through all the different steps and stages, settled on writing. Then after I got out of college, I of course couldn't find work in the Bay Area. So, and I didn't want to move to LA. I did not want to move to LA. I think mostly I was just intimidated by it. I didn't know anybody. I didn't want to, you know, end up just parking cars and hoping for a career, you know. So I stayed in the Bay Area and took a bunch of different kinds of jobs. And at one point I was a house painter. I was working as a house painter, and I went to a party and I met this woman named Jenny Oz, who was a Foley artist at Sky Sound.
Oh, wow.
And so I asked her, I said, so how did you get in? What happened? How did you get in? She said, well, I started as a receptionist. And just this light went off in my head. And up until then, I had never learned how to type. I absolutely refused to learn how to type because I did not want to get stuck in an office job.
Sure.
So I immediately went and took a typing class, you know, kind of tried to, you know, learn everything I could about being a receptionist.
J, space, K, space. That's how I learned.
Yep, exactly. And you know, and then I just started looking at the want ads, you know, figuring I needed to get a job as a receptionist. I did get in with a real estate company. I was a receptionist there. And then one day I was looking in the want ads, and there was an ad for a receptionist for a fast-paced creative environment, and send your resume to this address. And I recognized the address because I knew where ILM was and I'd been interested in it. So I sent it off and then got an interview and sort of persisted, you know. It's like calling them every day, you can hire me. and I finally did. I got in, and that's how I got into ILM as a receptionist.
Wait, you were a receptionist too? Why don't I know that?
I was a receptionist in 1988.
Wow, that's the year I started at San Francisco State. 4 years later, I was the receptionist at ILM. That's crazy.
It is crazy. It's wonderful.
I didn't know that. I feel like I should have known that all these years. Like that was where I started. I didn't know you started doing that.
The springboard. That's what they called it. You know, they called the reception desk the springboard, because from there you could just move into any other place in the company.
So who was it, just you, or was it busy enough that you had a tag team with another person at the desk?
Oh no, there? we had a tag team. Camille Salucci was a receptionist the same time I was. Elizabeth Bunshu, Elizabeth Mooney. I don't know if you knew her. She was gone by the time you got there.
Yeah.
But there were a number of receptionists, and yes. Yeah, so well, it was no, Scott.
so So that's so real quick. So that's so interesting. So 1988, you land a job as a receptionist at ILM, and how you had heard of ILM just from, you know, stories in the news and things like that, and being in the Bay Area.
Yeah, and movies, you know, watching, you know, Star Wars and all that, you know, you sit through the credits, Industrial Light and Magic. But I think the thing that really got my attention or focused my attention on ILM was, in fact, an article in the Marin IJ that was talking about this local company that was doing all this cool stuff. And so that's what set my sights on that particular company.
That's cool. So 88, you come to work at ILM. And were you living in Marin? Or were you in Berkeley?
Yes, I was living in San Rafael at the time. Yeah.
Oh, wow. Convenient.
Yeah. Yeah. I lived in San Francisco for 10 years and then moved to San Rafael in 1985.
Okay.
I was working as a caregiver for adult schizophrenics in a halfway house in Greenbrier.
That's how you could describe working at ILM too.
Well, exactly, because during my interview when I told the interviewer that that's what I did, she just laughed and said, "Oh, you will be perfect for this job."
Yeah. It's
you
so
can work
good.
With schizophrenics. You can work with this population.
Yeah. I think that is like an ILM kind of sense of humor joke for sure.
Yeah.
That's so good. Well, so you work at the front desk, and is there, you had said earlier that you had started to think you had an interest in working with the camera, doing as a DP or a camera operator. Was that something when you were looking at ILM, you know, you got your foot in the door, you're answering the phones and doing whatever they had the receptionist do, right? Running around. And was there in your mind, did you see something there where you're like, oh gosh, I'd really love to do that? Or as you're sort of getting to walk around and meet people and stuff, were there things that you saw that you were gravitating towards?
I was in love with the model shop, and every break I would go over to the model shop and I would just bug these guys. I'd, you know, Lauren Peterson would be working on something and he'd be like, "So what are you doing?" And of course, the kindest man in the world, he would always stop and explain to me and show me what he was doing. And that was such a privilege. Back then I didn't recognize how extraordinary that experience was. But now I look back on it and it was like, oh my God, it was, you know, it was the greatest gift to be able to learn this industry from the people who pretty much developed it. You know, it's so I think I was very fortunate. I mean, it was definitely one of those right place at the right time situations. To get back to your question about camera work, I didn't have the confidence, you know, I didn't think they would ever let me into the camera department. You know, first of all, it was all these guys, you know, these surly union guys. And, you know, and I just didn't have the confidence to even ask, you know, but during the first year I was a receptionist, I was pretty much just cruising and like you said, looking for a place to fit in. And I eventually decided that maybe I should be a producer and stay in the production track. So I, you know, after a year on the phones, I became a PA. My first project was Back to the Future 3 with Ken Ralston as VFX suit, Patty Blau as producer, and Kim Bromley as coordinator. So that was my first job as in production. And just went from there. And
were you enjoying it? Did you really like doing that? Like, I mean, getting that opportunity. I mean, were you having a good time? Were you enjoying that universe, do you think?
Oh, I loved it there.
Yeah.
I loved it. I loved the energy. I loved the people. I mean, the job, of course, was very stressful and I made a lot of mistakes and had a lot to learn. But I didn't want to be doing anything else. I really
what
didn't.
Were your mom and dad still around at this time?
Oh, yes. Yeah.
And what did they think of, like, their little daughter's cool new job that she had.
Oh, they were so proud of me. I mean, I, you know, they fully exploited the bragging rights.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's kind of cool, you know, all the just the fun things you do. I would think as a parent, like all the things you do with your kid when they're little, like you describe all the watching the movies and like building models with your brothers and things like that. Like, and then this opportunity, you know, well, you kind of make the opportunity. I mean, you're seeking it out, and then you wind up kind of landing something that's, you know, it's not only tangentially connected to the movie business. It is a huge part of the movie business. And yeah, you're kind of now doing this thing. I mean, I just would think as parents, like they must have been so stoked. Like, what did we do? How did this happen? And that's so cool.
It is. It is. And I'm so grateful that I was able to give them that. Mm-hmm. I think it did mean a lot to them. It meant a lot to them to.
And you must have been able to like take them through and show them stuff, right? Did you ever give them a little? Yeah, yeah.
I did. And they loved it. They loved it. So I remember going to the crew screening of Back to the Future 3, and I took my mom to it. And when the credits came up, we sat there clutching each other's hands, waiting for my name to come up on the screen, my first credit. And we were just like crying together. It was so exciting.
Oh, that's so great.
It was very sweet.
That's really, really neat. So, all right. So you work as a production assistant on Back to the Future 3. And then do you stay in production?
I stayed in production. Let me see. It was for a couple years. I guess I went into production in 1989. Around 1992 or so, ILM became very slow. And I was still a PA. They reduced ranks. I think they just went down to core people. So they went from, you know, a couple hundred people down to about 90 people.
Yeah.
And I was laid off at that point. Took a trip to Europe, took myself to Europe because I wanted to go in Paris. And when I got back, I got a phone call, and bless his heart, Mark Miller had recommended me to this little company in San Francisco that was looking for a coordinator. So I applied, I got an interview with that company, turned out to be Skellington Productions. And I was hired as stage coordinator for Nightmare Before Christmas.
Oh, how cool.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah. So that was pretty cool. And worked on Nightmare for about a year, and then went back to ILM where I was hired back as a coordinator. Yeah.
What a great experience too, though, because you get a chance to see a different kind of filmmaking for sure at the Skellington, mm-hmm. right? It wasn't that was what it was called,
yeah,
right?
Skellingtons, yeah.
And
yeah.
So you get a chance to see kind of a different style of filmmaking. And certainly, you know, it was that kind of show. I think it was well soup to nuts, right? They were doing the whole thing in that mm-hmm. space. Mm-hmm. And then you learn so much, I would think too, like, cause you're just seeing a whole different way of working that you bring back. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Absolutely. And again, there was so much model involved because, you know, I mean, I think,
sure,
you know, if I had to do my life over again, I would have been a model maker because I really do love that. I love the fabrication of little tiny detail-y things. It just makes me happy.
Yeah,
it
sure.
makes me happy. So, you know, and so that was, you know, and I was on the stages. I was coordinating the ins and outs of all the props and puppets and sets and so that was fun. I had tons of fun, and it was really excellent because a number of people from ILM were actually working on the project. All, you know, all the motion control guys were there. And so it was familiar.
Yep.
You know, it was, and then there were new people, so that was exciting. And I loved it. You know, I loved, I just loved working, seeing all that come to life, you know, seeing all that stop motion and the puppets come to life, and had no idea that it was going to turn into a cult film, but you know, that's kind of how it is when you're working on something, you have no idea where it's going to go. You just put all into it. And then it has a life of its own afterwards.
Well, I think sometimes too, like, I mean, that's a funny thing is like some of my favorite memories of working on films are working on films that, to be honest, I never even saw. You know, like movies that are just kind of bad movies and like, but it was the most fun, you know, like it was the greatest group of people and we, you know, worked really hard and we tried really hard to do everything we could to make it as best as it could be. But you kind of knew like, well, I don't know if this will be any good, but like, whatever, I'm having a great time at work anyway. So post Skellington, you go back to, ILM and what do you go to work on?
I went back to be a VFX coordinator on Star Trek Generations, and Wolf, the movie Wolf, you know, and a number of other shows, small shows. And it was during the time that I was at Skellington's, computer graphics was being developed at ILM. They had Casper. They had done Casper. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. They just won an Academy Award for Forrest Gump, you know, and the whole feather. Yeah, that beautiful shot, that beautiful animation that Pete Dalton did. And again, right place at right time. They were training people up. You know, model makers got to train in computer graphics modeling, camera operators or compositors got to train to do their job in computer graphics. And as a coordinator, you know, I was starting to walk around with the supervisors to different workstations. And so I would just be standing there watching these artists work in 3D or work in, you know, doing their magic on the screen. And oh my gosh, that's when I just lit up and it was like, that's what I want to do. That's the job for me, to sit at a computer.
It's so interesting because I feel like that moment in time too, it really is a sea change in, I mean, you know, movies are always in essence, right? Even if they're quote unquote 3D, it's always 2D, right? It's this image projected on a flat screen, right? Mm-hmm. And the computer, even if you're working in 3D, right? It's all 2D. It's a virtual version of a 3D space.
Yeah.
It's interesting the transition from that physical tactile universe of model building, even working at Skellington on Nightmare Before Christmas, right? You're working with, you know, it's all these little puppets and actual physical sets and things of that nature. And then everything starts to become, you know, for the most part, virtual, right? Mm-hmm. These virtual constructions and stuff. But that was something for you. I mean, I would probably share that sentiment, I think, if you concur, but like I was so into that too. It made sense to my brain and I was like, oh cool, it's like it's all right there and you have so much more control. But did you feel that too, like that was kind of your
absolutely I didn't even have words for it. It was just this visceral feeling of excitement and want, and I just wanted to have my hands in it. I wanted to be a part of that. I wanted to do that work.
Yeah.
And I knew I could, you know, because of everything else I did, you know, I knew I had the eye for it. I knew I had the skill sets, you know, to learn how to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And so what I did when they were starting to train people, you know, they had not yet begun training people out of production. It was still training the skilled artists, the people who were already artists in other departments they were training. So I went to John Ellis, who was sort of the head of all that at the time. And I asked him, what do I need to do to get hired as a rotoscope artist? Because I figured, well, roto, I can get into roto.
It's a good way in, sure.
Yeah, yeah. So what do I need to do? And he told me, you know, take a Unix class, learn how to do the job, and just be prepared. And that was that was great advice. He said, just be prepared. So when the opportunity comes up, you can apply. And so that's what I did. I trained after hours, took a Unix class. Photoshop 1 had just come out. So I did a lot of touch up on old family photos. You know, I used Photoshop, I learned Photoshop to do all this just to show that I had a skill level and that I could in fact paint and I could manipulate the tools. And so I put together a little portfolio of this work that I did through training. And then the next time they needed rotoscope artists, I applied and I was hired as a rotoscope artist in, I think, 1994.
Mm-hmm.
And I worked on Congo, was the first job as a rotoscope artist, then Twister and 101 Dalmatians. And then at some point they needed match movers. And, you know, and of course, back then they couldn't just put a posting out and get match movers. I mean, nobody out in the world was actually doing this work.
Yeah, it was so specific.
It was so specific. There were so few people who actually had access to the technology. So I applied for that because I thought, well, this would be a cool opportunity to learn how to work in a 3D software program.
Well, and it brings you back to that idea of the camera too.
Exactly, exactly. And so I was hired on as a match mover for Mission Impossible. The idea was that it would just be a one-time deal and I'd go back to rotoscoping. And I was fine with that. It's like, great, no problem. You know, as long as I can just keep doing this, I'm happy. And but then it turned into more of a, you know, show after show, we need match movers. And, you know, so that's how I, and then, and oh, again, I want, and my goal after that was, like, I really wanted to move into compositing. Mm-hmm. So I thought compositing would be a really fantastic job. But then when ILM went union, because the computer graphics department went union,
mm-hmm.
We all got contracts. And when my contract came through, they had just put me in as a match mover, you know, and if I'd wanted to go into compositing, I would have probably stayed in rotoscope, you know, because that was the path. And, you know, and I thought about it for a minute and I thought, well, fine, I'll be a match mover. You know, again, the cameras, this is, you know, I have.
And isn't that, that's when those contracts, they offered most everybody a 3-year contract, wasn't that what it was?
Yeah, it was a 3-year contract with a 25% pay increase. It was fat. It was great.
Yeah, it was something that I know for some people in management, that was a tough one to swallow. But I mean, even me as a young kid, like not long out of school, like I remember I got a contract at that time, a 3-year contract. And I was like, wow, this is pretty cool. You know, I just sort of assumed that was in a very ignorant way, you know, because what other experience did I have? I just sort of assumed like, oh, this is just normal. This is what it means to go to work in the movie business.
Rare, so privileged.
yeah, totally.
Yeah. So I stayed in Match Move and then I had the opportunity. Actually, I thought I might want to, you know, move into animation. I've studied animation, you know, but then I had the opportunity to go on location and start doing location work on high-end live action sets. And that's what finally hooked me into Match Move forever. I've been a match mover for 29 years. Who in their right mind would do that kind of job for 29 years? But the opportunity to go on location for me was again kind of feeding back into that childhood fantasy of
for sure
being on a movie set and making movies and all that.
What was the first show you got to go out on location for?
Galaxy Quest.
Oh, how fun. That's so cool.
Yeah. Oh, I made so many mistakes. I got yelled at all the time. But I am so grateful I had that opportunity. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, time is money. And yes, that can be frustrating, I guess, when mistakes are made. But, you know, you kind of have to have that trial by fire mm-hmm. to be able to learn how to do it and to know what's important and what's not important, you know?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was good. It was fun. One thing I didn't tell you, and I don't know if you know this, it's one of these very little known facts or little known bits of movie trivia. Do you know the film Abyss? The Abyss?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Do you know the shot where Mary Elizabeth Mastriantonio sticks her finger in the forehead of the pseudopod and there's a close-up insert of a hand going in? That's my hand.
All right. Yeah, that's fun. Yeah, that's
so
great.
I'm part of the ILM Body Parts Club.
Yeah, there's so many good ones like that. I remember, I think it was, I don't remember which Star Trek it was, but it was the one with the Borg Queen. Mm-hmm. I don't remember which one that was, one of the Next Generation movies. And there's this close-up of the Borg Queen's mouth. And it's Betsy Cox, the who used to be my office mate. And I just remember thinking, oh, that's so funny, because she had this similar kind of mouth shape, I guess.
Oh, funny. Yeah. And then on I think it was the third Back to the Future, there's a scene where Marty's girlfriend is opening something in a car and you just see her hands. And those are Maggie Bell's hands.
Oh, that's so great. Yeah, and like the funniest one that was, and I have a picture of it somewhere too that he sent me. But Paul Hill played Sean Connery in the sidecar in a shot that. For yes. What was it?
Last Crusade? Yeah, Last Crusade. Yeah.
That's so hilarious. Good, like with his little beard and like a little goatee they put on him and stuff, and that little sort of Sherlock Holmes-ish kind of. Twill cap kind of thing. Yeah, it's so funny.
Yeah.
So it's so fun. Good. So you're working, getting an opportunity to go out on set, and do you continue doing the location stuff?
That tapered off, and when I started leading shows. So then I, was leading Match Move for a number of shows, Men in Black, some Harry Potter films, and so I worked as a lead and didn't go out on location quite as much. So
you started at ILM in 88 and you left to go to Skellington. You came back, and did you stay pretty much gainfully employed at ILM after that? Because I mean, it started to get to the point where it felt really busy up until I left in 99.
Yeah.
And yeah, I was already put onto another show when I was like, I was like, I've got this other thing I'm going to go do. And I bailed, but mm-hmm, it was mm-hmm. like, it felt like there was work for the foreseeable future for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. Once I returned to ILM in 1993, 94, I stayed continuously employed there until 2013. So yeah, it was long stint. It was a nice
A really good run. Let's see, 88. Yeah. 2013. So
it was 24 years and 8 months.
So you got your 20. Did you get your 20 year statue?
I did. I have my C3PO. Yes, I do.
That's like the corniest thing ever, but I mean, it's kind of neat. It's a neat milestone,
It is.
It's so Lucasfilm to do that. Something so goofy like that.
Now that Disney owns the company, they get like Mickey Mouse statues. It's more Disney oriented.
Yeah, that's not as cool.
Not as cool. I know. I had hoped that I could have stayed long enough to get my R2-D2.
Yeah.
Because 30 year anniversary is an R2-D2 in a little glass case.
Ooh, fancy.
Oh, I know. I wanted one of those so bad.
So you stay at ILM until 2013, and then. Like, what do you do after?
After that, well.
You had made this. So you went to the Presidio too then, right?
Yeah, I was at the Presidio. Yeah. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. After that, there was sort of a turn in fortune for me. It was sort of a perfect storm of negative stuff. I lost both my parents within a month of each other in 2009. I had a total hip replacement on that hip that had been operated on when I was 3 in 2010. And I was laid off from ILM when Disney bought the company in 2013 or 2012, 2013, something like that. The last show I worked on at ILM was Pacific Rim. Mm-hmm. So it was kind of a perfect storm. And so after that, I was just pretty fried. I was fried from everything. You know, I was
yeah. That's a long career doing, you know, working in computer graphics. Like, that's a really long career where I think the burnout factor, I mean, just speaking for myself, I mean, and some other people I talk to, friends, like, I mean, it's high. There's a high burnout factor, yeah, after X number of years working that way. Like, you know, people think, I mean, it's a fun universe to work in, guaranteed. Mm-hmm. But I actually think sitting at a computer for many, many hours of the day, all day, every day, it's not digging ditches, but it is mm-hmm. hard work in its own way. And it can yeah. take a physical toll, I think, doing that work for a long period of time.
It does. It does. And just all the byproducts of doing all that sitting, not have, you know, just oxygen to the brain for one,
yeah.
you know?
Yeah.
It is. It's very
difficult. And we're the first generation to have gone through that universe mm-hmm. too, you know? I mean, now there's many subsequent groups of people that do that same kind of thing, but it was a big transition. I remember all the ergonomic training that they would do too.
Yes.
And they'd have people come and they'd measure the height of your desk and they'd yeah. give you a specific kind of chair and all these things to sort of like keep your yeah. arms in the right position. And yeah. even that stuff though was kind of, I'm sure there was some real science to it, but it always felt a little pseudosciencey to me. And I was always wondering, like, all right, but then how come some people still have all these like problems with their, you know, carpal tunnel or whatever the issue might be?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it might be specific to the individuals, but
yeah. Yeah.
I mean, they still, I had an ergo session last week, you know, so they're still doing that. They're still going through
yeah.
My desk was moved at work. And so I had an ergo person come and, you know, measure everything again.
so you have kind of some downtime and some, mm-hmm. some challenges that come about. And do you wind up going back to work in the industry?
I do. You know, actually, there was, this is interesting, yet another situation that will never, ever, ever happen again in the history of my life anyway. So I took about a year off. You know, I just decided I was going to detox from everything, you know, and you know, And like you said, you know, having that kind of tenure in an industry where that's all you do, you know, that really was all I did for 20 plus years. Your identity begins to merge with that career.
For sure.
So during that time after, you know, after I was unemployed, there was this whole kind of self-discovery that went on. It's like, okay, who am I? Independent of my parents, independent of ILM.
Yeah.
I'm out in the world now. You know, I'm an orphan in the storm. Who am I?
That's so good though, too. Like, I mean, yeah. it can be challenging, but I feel like, yeah, that's such a kind of, it's a great thing to have an opportunity to really take stock of one's life, of oneself, and have the opportunity to sort of, yeah, do that kind of self-assessment. I think that's so valuable.
Oh, yeah. It was necessary. It was absolutely necessary. And I'm grateful I had the resources to be able to do that.
Yeah, I suppose it's a great privilege too, right? Yeah.
Yes, it is. It is quite a privilege. But after about a year of that, I got in contact with my friend Terry Molitori. And she was, she told me about a little gig that she had. Basically in C building of Kerner C mm-hmm. building, some former ILM artists sort of took over. A few of them started just a little startup VFX company called CamD that was in C building at Kerner, and they mm-hmm. were in the large graphics room where computer graphics and Pixar was born, right?
Yeah.
And so she said, you know, they're not paying anybody. They don't have any projects, but, you know, people just show up and we get to use their equipment. And I thought, well, that's a great idea. I can at least keep my software chops up if I can, you know, and there's like a social component to it. I'm actually seeing
yeah,
it.
So yeah.
I started going in once or twice a week. Pretty soon I was just going in every day like it was a regular work day. None of us were getting paid, but we were having so much fun. we were working on, you know, test projects and animations, and the whole time they were trying to get work in for us. They eventually did get a project. It came in through Steve Rosenbaum to do, and the focus of their company was digital humans. That was the kind of the focus of the company. So we were doing all this development, and, you know, with when we had no projects in digital humans. And then we got this project to do Michael Jackson for the Billboard Awards in 2014. And so we developed a Michael Jackson asset, and I went on location, you know, for the shoot, and we made it. That was in the Billboard Awards. Michael Jackson singing a song that he had not yet released called Slave to the Rhythm. Mm-hmm. So that was really cool. And then after that, the people who hired us to do the project bought the company, and we became Pulse of Evolution. And we had a number of we got the rights to a number of celebrities. We had Elvis, we had Marilyn Monroe, and although we had no projects for them, we spent the next 2.5 years developing their assets, beautiful assets. And then the company folded, and we never did another project. But it was just the weirdest thing, because we were all employed, we all had health benefits, and no project. We were just
kind of like playing. An R&D studio.
Yeah,
almost.
It was like an R&D studio. It was so much fun. Some people wrote a script about Elvis's life. I was not in on that, and I'm sorry I missed out on it, because it turned into a really wonderful, wonderful story. I for my part was doing experiments with photogrammetry and scanning humans and getting 3D scans of human faces, that sort of thing. So yeah, it was fun. It was fun.
That's cool.
And then that folded. And I decided at that point, I sort of felt at that point that maybe my career was over. Maybe it was time to just move on and do something else. I'd been doing this for so long.
Yeah.
And I knew I didn't want to have to go to Vancouver or anywhere else for work.
Chase the tax subsidies around the globe. Yeah.
Yeah. I didn't want to do that. So I just sort of hung out a little bit, trying to decide what it is I wanted to do. And then COVID hit. That's not true. Before COVID hit, I went and taught at the Academy of Art University. I taught matching.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, I did.
Yeah, with Catherine and...
With Catherine Tate, yes.
Yeah.
And so I was a teacher at the Academy. And then COVID hit, and all my classes went remote. And then for the next semester, there was the enrollment was so low that they canceled my classes. So I was sort of out of work again. The silver lining of lockdown was that remote work became popular. And it was during that time that I went to work for Digital Domain doing facial tracking on a game, and then on She-Hulk. So I worked on She-Hulk as a facial tracker for Digital Domain. And then I got hired at Leica. So now I'm at Leica.
That's cool. And for Leica, are you working remotely for them, or are you?
No, I'm here in Portland.
And, oh, you are? Okay.
I'm the camera match move lead, so I have to go into studio. And so it's kind of a nice blend, because I'm doing camera match move, and yet it's a puppet show. So I get to go.
Yeah, it's kind of a cool synthesis of all the things that you've described. That's so neat.
Yeah, it's an appropriate bookend to my career, I think.
Well, it might not be the bookend. Maybe it's just another chapter, you know? Come on. I'm so curious, though. I have to ask you something that I'm kind of curious about, because I've been teaching for a long time now, and I have a bunch of students this semester in a visual effects class, and we're making a short film, and we've been doing a bunch of camera match moves, and something that I'd never really spent a lot of time doing. So I've learned how to do a lot of it using Nuke mostly, and Nuke's camera tracker. Okay. Mm-hmm. But I'm curious, like, from your perspective, camera match moves, like in those early days at ILM when they were generating 3D camera match moves with the, and you'd lay in the checkerboard on the ground plane, and you'd have cones for the eye tracking of where people mm-hmm. were looking, and put in different sort of cubes and blocks and whatnot. I remember seeing those all the time in dailies and on the call them, disc recorders or whatever they were for shots that would get posted on those things. And it was a lot of that work, if I'm not mistaken, or even most of that work, it was done by hand, right? I mean, it was all like kind of, it was like rotoscoping in 3D in a way, right?
Don't ever say that.
Well, I mean,
I got so mad at John Burton was because he said, oh, match moves, just 3D rotoscoping. It's so much.
Well, okay. I did it. Oh my God, I said the wrong thing. But so now so much of the processes, correct me if I'm wrong, this is where I guess I'm asking. So many of the processes that were really like done by hand, that were really complex, like in the early days, have become partially automated. Yeah. Or.
Yes. Certainly I learned how to match move in Softimage by hand.
Yeah.
And not only cameras, but match animation or object tracking. That was all done by hand. I worked on Men in Black, Frank the Pug, his little mm-hmm, face and his mm-hmm. lips moving. All that tracking on his face was done by hand with, you know, a 3D mesh. ILM developed tracking software. And of course they developed the most incredible match move package on the planet. Since I've left, I've not yet seen anything that even remotely compares to those tools. And I lament every single day. I wish I had Zeno. Best match move package in the world. Anyway, they developed tracking. So by mid 90s, started with the Crimson Tracker, and then it moved into, you remember that one, and then it moved into Zeno. And so, over time it became more automated. And what I'm finding with the younger artists that I supervise now is that they do not know how to do a match move by hand. And honestly, there are times like with really, really, really difficult shots, I'm much faster doing it by hand than I am doing it procedurally. But the tracking is procedural, and actually, object tracking can be procedural too. Yeah, it's all done in procedurally. Yeah. But I find that the final pass by hand is what gives it its je ne sais quoi.
Well said. Yeah. So have you seen? I'm so curious. Have you seen in any of the sort of alpha? As we speak right now, this is March 25th, 2023. There's a bunch of these tools that are in alpha right now that are all kind of machine learning based tools that can do all kinds of image processing in terms of segmentation, tracking, solving in real time. Have you seen some of these things?
I have seen some of them, and it's extraordinary. Freaky. Yeah, it's really amazing. I mean, you know, the stuff you can do on your phone at this point is incredible.
Yeah.
At DD, they were doing facial tracking with machine learning, we did some of that. It's pretty cool. It's pretty cool stuff.
It's cool. Yeah, there's a video that's out of some company that I don't know if it's how real it is. They have a demo video. It's called Wonder Dynamics. Mm-hmm. And it's a whole visual effects pipeline where you can like replace a human with a 3D character, and it does, for the most part, it does the match move, the compositing, the lighting, the camera. It's freaky. It's so freaky. We'll see how real it is, but I feel like it's going in that direction, that we're going to be like so many things will become more automated. It's kind of strange. So maybe it will be a short-lived window of time where some of these jobs even existed, you know? It's so interesting.
Well, I'm close to retirement. So.
Yeah. And I basically have retired from the visual effects business now. I'm just a college teacher now. But well, that's great. So you're up in Portland and you're working at Leica and you're having a good time, it sounds like. Yeah.
It is. It's a challenging project. I mean, I don't know if I can talk too much about it. You know, it's been announced. So the project is called The Wildwood, based on a children's book. And it's the biggest, most complex show Leica has ever done. It's about 2,700 shots. It's a hybrid show. So whereas in their previous four movies, they did as much as they could in camera with just with visual effects just sort of peppered in through the movie, this show, a lot of the puppets are being shot against blue screen, and we're putting in set extensions. And so there's a lot of 3D work going on. There's some scenes where we're actually bringing in 3D animated puppets and characters that match the puppets, so they might shoot the principal actors as puppets and then all the background characters might be CG.
That sounds fun though.
It is pretty fun. Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah. Problems to solve for sure.
Yeah. Yeah.
And yeah. Does it have a release date?
I don't know if it has a release date.
Release I've year.
I've been told I'll be working on this till the end of 2025. So.
Oh, well, that's cool. Well, that's kind of nice to know you've got like a guaranteed gig for at least a little while longer.
Yeah. That's why I say it might be a bookend. On the other hand, I might decide that I want to keep plugging away at it. Right now, our DP on the show is Caleb Deschanel. So he's the DP and he's up there.
Yeah.
He's still doing it. He's still working. That's an inspiration.
If you're healthy and you love what you do, like, and you can get up every day and go to work and you still derive, enjoyment, pleasure, mm-hmm. from the experience, like, why not? Unless you've got a fish you want to fry, so to speak.
Yeah, or go to the beach every day. I mean, that's my fantasy.
That wouldn't be so bad either. Yeah.
No, that would not be bad at all. But yeah, so I'm in a good place, knock on wood.
Yeah.
And, and I'm very grateful for this opportunity because I really did think that my visual effects career was over. Really did think that, okay, I'm done. It's time to bow out gracefully and all that kind of stuff. So I feel very fortunate that I have this opportunity at this point, and it's a great place and a great show to work on. And so,
well, and too, like, I mean, just your whole story. I mean, what a great career. Like, you've had so many amazing opportunities that you've seized, that have come your way, and opportunities you've created as well, where you've had this incredible career. You've worked on so many films and so many like huge groundbreaking films too, that, people all over the world have seen, like, it's such a cool life to have lived. And not only that, but the story you tell at the beginning about like your sort of origin story and your family's background. I mean, it's just really, really fascinating. And like, what a cool life story.
Thank you. Thank you. Yeah. Immigrant kid makes good.
Yeah. You get the gold star. Well, listen, Aaliyah Aga, it is so great to see you. It's just fantastic to see you again, to talk with you. And thank you so much for coming and talking with me and sharing your story.
Well, thank you, Matt. I appreciate seeing you again. And I hope we can do this again sometime.
Yeah, for sure.
Absolutely.